Casey working on getting Andrew. And, yeah, Andrew's just asking. Casey working on the phone line, and Andrew Offerman, Casey just asked me, he said, explained to him that you were getting the phones. Getting the phones rebooted, a little the little Soulchild remix of Gorillaz. Thanks to Michael Ann Ewing, who I can't believe. I cannot believe it's 10 years. When she said that, I was like, oh, my gosh. That surprised me. But I remember when she got her first win, and I'm just looking. It was, 2011. Holy cow. She had been an assistant to... Bob Hess, and then went out on her own, and obviously has got some wherewithal to run to train and run her own horses, but she from limited starters for this whole period, has won consistently. I mean, some years. Just 30 and 40 starters. And then last year got up to 76 starters. And as she said, she's got two dozen that she's got her hands on right now. But she's got a lot of friends. She talked about the West Coast and the West Coast origins and then making the move to Kentucky. And she's sharp. She knows what she's doing. So kind of excited for her to get that Barrister Tom and a $500,000 stake. And as she said, biggest career win. Well, it's been a fast summer and obviously an abbreviated summer in Shakopee. And Canterbury is going to wind down tomorrow and Thursday. And I wanted to get Andrew Offerman in for a chance to, essentially to dote on his staff and on the team at Canterbury, because the racing has been really good. Canterbury again with an aggressive attempt at low takeout when it came to the pick five, the 10% really paid back players handsomely. And Andrew, congratulations on a terrific summer.
Appreciate it, Steve. Thanks for having me on. Like you said, the credit really goes to our horsemen and our staff who came together during some tough times like everybody else is facing and made the best of it. But I appreciate that. It's been a quick summer, as you mentioned, not used to being over and done with quite this quickly, but appreciate everybody's efforts and think it's turned out as good as we could have hoped for.
What's really notable, and you and I talked as plans were being made and as you worked with state government to get the season started, and you were going to be hard pressed in some ways, because the business that you've cultivated at Canterbury is substantial when it comes to attendance and on track patronage, and so it was going to be important to grab the attention of horse players, and you made certain decisions, including the Monday through Thursday schedule. And, then I think once people started to look and get a feel for the cards and a feel for the racing, they really latched on. Talk about the business side of it and what it means going forward as well.
Certainly. Yeah. As you'd mentioned, we're used to drawing in excess of 6,500 people per race day, which is a robust on-track business when it comes to not only wagering, but also admission, food and beverage, and those revenue streams. So to get cut back to what ended up to be about 10% of that was our maximum capacity throughout the summer. We were able to have up to 750 people per race day, made for some dramatic changes. Like we talked about, the change to Monday through Thursday and in a late afternoon time slot that was maybe not a traditional start time, I think was very helpful to expose our product to a new group of people. We were able to, kind of get out there and get going maybe a week or 2 weeks before the industry really saw a significant uptick in the number of venues that were racing, which I think was also helpful in kind of getting our name out in the market. And we really started, strong basically doing about 100% of our average daily off-track handle, and that number is just kind of steadily climbed a little bit week by week. So we're, you know, going into the last weekend, we're doing about 110% of what we've been doing in off-track handle per day throughout the course of the meet, which has been excellent, very encouraging, very happy to see the support that people have brought to us, and the fact that even through you know, much more competitive months in July and August, we've seen our numbers in many cases not only stay constant but actually improve. So I think we've built some good market awareness throughout that time slot on some non-traditional days. And you know, where we go from here, I think probably in part is led by kind of what happens with entertainment venues and capacities. But I do think that we've learned that there's some opportunity out there for us to explore with horse players in some different time slots and on some different days of the week than maybe we've done traditionally.
The typical schedule, and you know, when do you have to put your dates in for 2021?
Sure, our racing commission requires our dates request to go in November. So I'm actually meeting with myself, our CEO Randy Sampson, and our horsemen's group later this afternoon, so we can kind of start the process of what we're looking to for next year. But I have no doubt that it likely will be at a minimum a hybrid of what we've done in the past, and maybe it looks a lot similar to this year, just based on kind of what our expectations are for capacity and what we're going to see. You know, we draw, like I said, a little over 6,000 people a day, but in some parts that's made up from some substantially large days, you know, in excess of 10 or 15,000 people. And I think everybody recognizes that those aren't going to be feasible, even in the medium term. So there'll be a conscious attempt to kind of make sure that we can blend some of the stalwarts of our on-track business, but make sure that we're also putting ourselves in a position to be more prominent nationally, because I, like I said at the beginning, really can't thank the horse players for their support enough, and the fact that we've not only seen people kind of come to us, but they've also stayed with us and brought their friends, and that doesn't go unnoticed.
Well, the pressures that were, you know, were evident, you know, from early on, the importance of, you know, being able to maintain field sizes. And from that standpoint, the racing office really did an amazing job, able, you know, not, and I don't mean just to finish the season tomorrow and Thursday with these big cards and these big fields, but, you know, there was obviously a point where some other venues opened and, you know, some people gravitated to, you know, venues where they, you know, they typically run more often, and it made things a challenge, and the racing office was able to be creative and keep the cards interesting. And then, you know, when it came particularly to the pick five, I mean, that part of it was telling its own story, including, you know, you had some of that divine intervention early on with those crazy paydays that have to get people's attention.
Without a doubt, like you said, I can't give enough credit to our racing office. I mean, they started the meet, you know, with, I think, a horse population that was ready to run, given the fact that so many people had been you know, pretty much without a venue to run at for 30 or 60 days. So I think that at the beginning of the meet, starting strong was kind of a given, but they really were able to continue to keep the momentum going through July and August. You know, when I expected maybe there to be a little bit of a let up, they were able to continue to fill cards, continue to fill cards 4 days a week. And that was really doing so with, you know, for probably 200 to 250 horses short of where we would normally be in a given year, just given the uncertainty with people and where they were traveling from. We did not have the horse population that we normally would have. So major credit to Rob Junk and his team for what the work that they did to keep our cards compelling and, like you said, continue to produce competitive and interesting fields that really generated an interest in our pick five. Like you said, a couple of those massive payouts at the beginning sure probably brought some interest, but that pool has really held up consistently over the course of the summer, averaging just about $75,000 a day, which for us, when you consider that our pick fours in the past were our highest handling pools at an average of about $25,000 or $30,000, has done amazing things to bring attention to our racing and to our wagering.
When it comes to when it came to the flow, and because I, you know, in addition to watching the daily pick five numbers, you know, I would look at the, you know, at the total handle nightly, and it, particularly when the field size was a bit of a struggle, you could see though that the, you know, the nightly number, the which was essentially seven figures, I think virtually every day of the meet. It might have slipped under a couple of times, but it kind of said to me that, you know, you had glommed on, and that players, you know, were coming back to you, even if the, you know, even when the field size wavered a little bit, and that had to be encouraging.
Without a doubt, I think you hit it right on the head. In the past, maybe I'd been concerned that the promotion would be a little bit of a flash in the pan, and that, like you said, after a few weeks and other options out there, maybe people would turn their attention elsewhere. But our numbers really did hold up very well throughout the course of the summer, especially during the middle of Del Mar and Saratoga's meet. And like you'd said, we really were able to consistently stay in the seven figures, and especially on Wednesdays and Thursdays, the mid-seven figures throughout the entirety of the summer. So even on some of our maybe a little bit less compelling or not quite as strong cards, we were still putting out strong numbers. So it was very encouraging and just very appreciative that people stuck with us even during the more challenging times. And with that, we get a couple of fun days at the end of the year. The end of our meets always a fun couple of days when everybody's entered and we put on big cards with big fields.
You got me curious too. With the calendar the way it is, where will this, you know, we followed a lot of the horsemen that moved over to Canterbury from Fawner, and
sure.
Where will a lot of these horsemen go next?
It's a great question. You know, it's a lot of our horsemen, like you said, have come from Nebraska or Phoenix, and with a lot of the uncertainty that these Phoenix is facing. There's a lot of people going to new places this winter. The other challenge for some of our horsemen is that a lot of them had stalled at Delta. So I know for a fact that a large portion of our horse population is going to be headed to Hawthorne. And there's a handful of people that are headed towards Mountaineer and waiting for Tampa to open. So I think that's probably in the short term the most likely place you are to see the most number of horses kind of pop up again as at Hawthorne here in a few weeks.
Well, and it's funny regarding, and one of the reasons I thought to ask in conversation, or, you know, kind of going back and forth to get Bob Hutton to visit from Arizona,
sure,
with the latest on the situation there, which includes the difficulties regarding Turf Paradise. And so Bob Hutton is going to join us tomorrow with the latest on what is really a saga at this point when it comes to Arizona. It's hard to believe. I mean, it just, that things could get worse, but they seem to have. A couple of notes. Andrew Offerman with us from Canterbury, kind of celebrating and waving the finish line flag on the season. Tomorrow there's the carryover, $41,000 pick five carryover, races 9 through 13, and we'll look at that tomorrow. And then on Thursday, when they'll obviously everything, you know, mandatory payouts on things like the jackpot pick six, but there's also a couple of stakes too, the Shakopee Juvenile as well as the HBPA to close out the card.
Correct. Yep, those have been closing week stakes here for a long time. They're two kind of fun ones, the Shakopee Juveniles for open two-year-olds, and the HBPA Sprint. The Mets and HBPA Sprint is a fun race. It's essentially a sweepstakes for horses that have never won an open stake before, so you see a good mix of some of the best allowance horses of the season with a couple of the best state breds of the meet usually facing off on that field, and those will kick off the pick six and the pick five, respectively, on Thursday night.
Very nice. Should Andrew also give you a chance, any other acknowledgments and thank yous to staff and the team and any other areas that help make things as successful as they've been?
No, I appreciate it. You know, we've gotten a substantial amount of help from the Minnesota Racing Commission and the Minnesota Department of Agriculture here that have understood how important it is to get this seasonal meet going and have done a lot of good work behind the scenes to make sure that it happens. So I have to express my gratitude to that group. My staff and our horsemen have really been excellent in doing what they need to do to not only get the job done, but to keep people safe, putting in a lot of time and really... when you consider how dramatically our schedule changed, it's a whole new lifestyle for a lot of those people this summer. So their flexibility and willingness to adapt has been great. And I couldn't go without thanking the horsemen, the horse players for their support. They've jumped in and really made this move successful. And it was a little bit of a leap of faith and a significant concern as far as how it was going to work out financially. But their support has been invaluable, and really appreciate the fact that they've dug in on that pick five and kept playing it throughout the summer, because I think it's brought us a lot of good attention. So appreciate all their help and appreciate your help, Steve, in getting us some attention and some promotion, and really appreciate everything that people have done to turn what could have been a real challenging season into something that Minnesota and Canterbury will be happy to celebrate.
No doubt, and it was really fun to look at the races and you know get familiar. That part of it is always a challenge too. I mean, players, you have to learn a new venue and get a feel, I think under the pandemic backdrop, considering how many of these riders and horsemen, participated at Fawner, for instance, and following some of those horses right on into your season was really helpful. And we'll try to finish strong. Try to hit one of these two closing day pick fives. Then tomorrow's probably the best day to do it with a $41,000 carryover.
Absolutely, and we didn't make it easy. I think there's 51 or 52 betting interests in that sequence tomorrow, so get your paper out.
I love it. Well, Andrew Offerman, congratulations again, and of course, the season also tinged with sadness, Mr. Sampson's passing earlier in the year, and I'm sure, I'm sure there'll be a Sampson Memorial on next year's calendar.
Without a doubt.
Pay tribute. Thanks for everything. And we'll probably talk to Brian Aragone, who I think has been also a revelation to people, a terrific handicapper and ticket builder. I think it's been a showcase. This meet has been a showcase for his talents as well.
Awesome. I appreciate it, Steve. Thank you.
Andrew Offerman and the team at Canterbury that closes out what has been, under real duress, a very successful season. And with the chance, ideally next year, to have the full, full attendance potential, and then the added awareness that's been built this year will go a long way. Canterbury Park, two more days of season. Canterbury. Really fun. Bottom of the hour, exactly bottom of the hour, in fact. 90 minutes in, 90 to come. I've always liked that as a little tagline. Tuesdays at 10:30 for many, many years has been Dr. All Day time, and it's going to be next, actually. We'll stay here, Case, and give Dr. A reach. And we'll talk to Steve about a couple of topics. And the sale as part of the focus, as always, when we talk to Dr. Allday, it's topics ripped from today's headlines. He'll talk to you about the role a vet plays at the sale. Each different sale is a little... it's different, but the two-year-old training versus the yearling side. And Steve will explain that. But the motivation, the even more than the sales topic, the injury and retirement, the injury to Honor AP and subsequent retirement, that I thought was a good topic for Steve to discuss because, you know, there's no, even though it was described as a minor tendon injury, there's no, there's no minor tendons. Any tendon injury is a problem. And so I thought that Steve could riff a little on the treatments and the options and, you know, what constitutes career ending when it comes to tendons. It probably can also fold in some suspensory issues as well as a topic. Strain, the term, in fact, soft tissue injury when it comes to horses, you know, gets used quite often. And here he is to discern the differences. Dr. Stephen Allday, Horse Health Today, brought to you by Luberson and Reborn. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you this morning?
I'm good, and you know, whenever we don't talk for a stretch, I have to first say, you know, I have to blame myself. But you know what? Knock on wood, there hasn't necessarily been some glaring veterinary topics for me to call you about. I say it's
no.
Today's headline.
Public health. Things, that's
right?
Not my area. Public health only.
Exactly.
Veterinarians do participate in public health, but they do not. We just participate only. We don't deck it into policy. We just deal with it.
Well, you know, I did right at the beginning, actually, of the pandemic, where I saw where people were asking questions about a coronavirus. And,
sure.
And absolutely, equine, you know, the equine can get coronaviruses of various ilks, but it's... You know, apparently not a, you know, not a, a huge issue for horses.
Well, no, it is actually. It creates tremendous diarrheas and things like
this.
Here's the deal: coronaviruses in veterinary medicine are very prevalent in lots of different species. We deal with them a lot, a long time. It's totally different, you know, as far as coronaviruses do occur in people too, but they're not nearly as prevalent and. You know, so I've got a lot of experience with dealing with it, especially diarrheas and calves, things like this, you know, over the years and whatnot. And so, but like I said, when it comes to this one, this is, you know, appears to be somewhat genetically, you know, manipulated a little bit. So it's a little different than, you know,
right.
the ones that have evolved in the past. So we'll just leave it at that and I'll keep the politics out of it. So.
Well, when you talk about the diarrhea side of it, I mean, the thing that I think about is more of a colitis, like a colitis X. I mean, more of a bacteria. Isn't that a bacterial issue?
Not necessarily. The way it usually works is that you know, colitis, you know, is anything that, you know, will create a tremendous irritation or inflammation to the lower bowel of the horse, and they can't absorb fluids. They get just unbelievably, like, you know, profuse diarrheas, and they dehydrate so rapidly and become toxic so quick, you know. And there can be a number of colitis X is, they give it the X branding because it tends to be multifactorial, and there are a lot of things that tend to kind of make it come together, so.
Use that to segue toward the news yesterday that Honor AP forced to retire, coming out of Derby with what sounds like the, you know, the aggravation, Steve, of a tendon, because he was being kind of gingerly handled, carefully handled by John Sheriffs.
Sure.
Talk a little bit and parse out the soft tissue injuries so that people understand what, you know, and obviously a horse like this that has got, you know, a big stallion career ahead of him, it's one thing that a minor, quote-unquote, tendon sideline him versus, you know, a useful horse that might still have a career after an injury like this. Kind of explain the differences and you know, what the treatment options are if you were to go on with a horse that... presents with you know, strain versus a bow versus inflammation.
Well, you know, I mean, there are horses that come up with injuries to tendons on a regular basis. The earlier that you can evaluate and be on the preventative side, the better off you are, obviously, because, you know, if it's not a major disruption in the fiber pattern to where there's a hole, quote-unquote a hole, then that is a major disruption in the fiber pattern. You can get these horses back. I can give you a perfect example, one that had it as a young horse because he was big and growthy as a two-year-old, but we always felt he had a lot of talent, at least the outfit that I work with, and that was a horse called Cigar. And we stopped on him, and everything came around, and they got good. We scanned it, and they had a little bit of a salt and pepper look to it, so there was a few little disruptions there, but not any major, you know, area that coalesced together. So that was good, and that's what you need to do. You got to stay, you know, preventative, stay on the healthy side, which is, you know, maybe a bit of a strain, so to speak, where you get just a slight disruption of area, but not a major coalescing of it. When you get the major coalescing, I mean, these things swell, they hemorrhage, they pull across a bunch of the cross-linking between there, or the cross-linking occurs as it scars and fills in. And the problem is they tend to re-scar and re-tear again over and over and over when this occurs, when you get a big coalesced area. We try to use different type of enzymes to stop the cross-linking from occurring. They've tried to put stem cells in them, you know, regularly to try things. And, you know, the bottom line is, I mean, there's an old adage about a bowed tendon, so to speak, and they, and it's a terrible saying, but unfortunately everybody knows this one, but, you know, there's only been one person doing any good with a bow, and that was Robin Hood, so, you know. It's terrible. I mean, I hate saying that. People say it works. It's tongue-in-cheek and laugh a little bit about it, but it's not good for both. The only... Robin might do okay with that bow. That horse certainly doesn't, so that's the bad part. So, but, you know, it's just, I'm a firm believer of preventative medicine. We talked about this a million and one times, Steve. You know, I go over these horses routinely to try to pick up early signs, you know, of things that will create asymmetry in a gait that could create an overload where a horse could potentially get a bow and or get a suspensory tear or soft tissue. And, you know, the more proactive you are in either discovering or trying to stay ahead of the potential of lameness issues or asymmetry, the more likely you are to not succumb or have, you know, those things occur. You know, bows that typically don't, you know, I mean, everybody will tell you the old bad step routine. Let me tell you what, that's a unicorn. and maybe there's a unicorn out there somewhere. I just haven't seen one yet. But bottom line is that, you know, typically these are stress injuries due to cyclic concussion and overload or asymmetry due to that cyclic concussion. That means repeated overload on an area over and over and over and over and over. And eventually it starts tearing fibers. That's what these things are due to, suspensories, you know, tendons, things like this. And this is why you got to, you know, that's why, you know, I try to preach, at least my people I work with, we try to stay on the preventative side of problems and injuries and lameness so we don't have things like this come up. So I don't know the horse personally, you know, just like I never knew anything about Mongolian Groom when he had his problem, whatever, but bottom line is that, you know, if you stay preventative and, you know, you stop before they becomes injury, hopefully you won't suffer a catastrophic, sequence or event eventually, like, you know, like a ruptured bow or a ruptured tendon, something like that, or succumb to a fractured cannon the way, you know, let's say, Mongolian Groom did. You know, and my hat goes off to John Shearer's because, you know, I mean, you can deal with these problems, and obviously the horse raced because he was, I think he finished third in the Derby or fourth?
Fourth,
yeah. So, I mean, the horse ran a decent race. But the point to all this is that, you know, he evaluated after, you know, maybe in something he was dealing with before, but he evaluated after and they made a wise decision to probably, you know, retire him to stud and we'll move on from there. So, but the horse lived to be a breeding horse and his genetics will get carried on, hopefully, and we'll go from there.
Flesh out, Steve, a little bit. The placement of the tendons. You know, we hear the term flexor tendon. You know, talk about the spots. You know, the placement of tendon, and you know how much of this, you know, how much of these injuries are. You seem to be kind of indicating, you know, some of this is confirmation and, you know, certain kinds of stresses that are placed, you know, based on the horse's movement. But explain, you know, where they are and which ones are most vulnerable, essentially, to injury.
Sure. Well, I mean, in a tendon in particular, there are two tendons. There's a superficial and deep flexor tendon that run down the back of the leg. They originate up in the forearm in a muscle belly, and then they become tendinous right there just below the knee, the carpus, and they become mostly just fibers. And obviously the deep is, you know, on closer to the cannon bone itself, and the superficial is on the outside. Most injuries do occur mainly in the superficial, with the deep being involved sometimes, obviously, but mostly superficial. And they can be either high, right behind the by the knee. They can be middle, right in the middle of the tendon itself, which is between the knee and the fetlock. Or they can be low, down closer to the sesamoids and or the fetlock. A bow is a bow, unfortunately. But, I mean, and if you had your druthers, you really wouldn't want any of the above, not, you know, any of the three. I mean, I can't tell you with any, you know, personal, you know, degree of, you know, satisfaction that one's any worse or better than the other to have, because I wouldn't want any of them personally. But typically the high bows aren't as bad as right away, and that horse can kind of tough it out and survive that a little longer. Middle's probably next, and the low bow seems to be the worst, you know, as far as prognostically. So, you know, and it's conformation-wise, back in the knee, obviously, on a young horse is more predisposed because they have more, basically, the entire thing takes more stretch because they tend to be, you know, they dorsiflex just a tick. Nothing stays stationary. I mean, these horses are going high speed. The more they fatigue, the more they tend to, you know, kind of stretch. The horses with long, soft pasterns or drop pasterns, things like this, they're more predisposed to get tendons, things like this as well. So, obviously, there's certain conformation things that you're going to stay away from, you know, that would contribute to this as well. Yeah. And like I said, I mean, not that it's going to make a difference, but my experience has been, you know, a lot of times, you know, it's due to asymmetry. Something that creates an asymmetry in the gait will make a bow tendon be exacerbated. And when it goes over and over and over, like in many, many cycles, that's how you end up having the injury. The overstretching and finally the coalescing and rupturing and tearing of the fibers in a locale or an area where it tends to like group together and it hemorrhages.
I've got two or three follow-ups. I just, by the way, on Twitter, I just put up a schematic that kind of shows the spots that Dr. Alday just explained. The suspensory ligament, the deep digital flexor, the superficial digital flexor, the long digital extensor, et cetera. You can get an idea of you know, the representation. Steve, two things as follow-up to this. The difference between suspensory strains and tendon strains, and then, you know, practical treatment to keep a horse in training, and you know, this is, you know, obviously a horse like Honor AP doesn't make a whole lot of sense to, you know, give him 4 months and you know, try to, you know, bring him back that way when you know, he's got a career waiting for him at Lane's End.
Sure.
But explain, if you've got a horse that strains one and you've got a, you know, a practical gelding that can run, you know, how do old school horsemen treat this and get it to, you know, to firm up and keep a horse competitive?
Well, I mean, there's been, over the years, things have kind of changed and developed, you know, and once upon a time, we used to just cool them out and blister them, which created a tremendous amount of scar tissue. But, you know, a lot of these things came back because the scar tissue was involved in a lot of cross-linking in the fibers, and when you started them back, the cross-linkings would tear between the fibers, and that would re-injure, so you were always kind of remodeling on a regular basis. The difference between the suspensory and the tendon is that the suspensory is much, much, much denser and much larger, and it attaches directly. It's not off a muscle belly, so it doesn't have nearly the amount of stretch. And it originates off the back of the can and goes down to the fetlock attached to the sesamoids. And then the distally, or at the end of it, it goes down into the pastern, into the XYZ components, or the what they call distal sesamoidal ligaments. And these things are all part of the same structure that originates out of the, you know, they're separate parts, like the sesamoid and the distal sesamoid ligaments and the suspensory proper and the body and the origin of the upper suspensory are all structures that are separate, but they all are combined and are attached together, okay? So, but it's much denser than a tendon, and a tendon has a lot of the ability to stretch a lot more, has a lot more stretchability, a lot more elasticity, so to speak. But, you know, eventually you can't, you know, you can only stretch something so far. When you stretch it too far or too much, eventually, you know, I mean, like anything, you start, some of the bands and or some of the fibers will start tearing. And like I said, a bow tendon that we see visibly is a coalescing or hemorrhage of a large area or a larger area of the tendon hemorrhaging and stuff underneath the skin. And of course, that's, you know, when you can visibly palpate, see it's painful, and, you know, and you know, that's when we realize we got a problem. That's when we get them scanned, typically. Hopefully beforehand, but, you know, we can pick up on these things fairly acutely, but bottom line is, you know, we try to get it down, get the edema out as quick as possible, and then make an assessment on, like, how much damage is done and, you know, what we could do. And like you said, your evaluation is perfect because, I mean, if a gelding doesn't make it as a racehorse, I mean, he's got nothing else, you know. But, I mean, sometimes if you can't get him back as a racehorse, I mean, these horses are, you know, they have a career change with something that doesn't put as much pressure on his racing. So, you know, you'll see him be somebody's flat horse, sometimes somebody's field hunter, somebody's show horse, something like this, if it's not too severe.
You hinted at a couple of things. How does it present? You know, when, how quickly as this starts to develop, because obviously the way you make it sound, it's not like a single incident. It's a buildup of strain. How does it present, and how do savvy horsemen first notice and get out ahead of it? And obviously, how important is it to stop it early? And if you, you know, if you literally get out in front of it in the first presentation, you know, how much, you know, how important is that to, you know, to prevent further damage?
Well, the only problem is, I mean, you know, you typically have, you know, one that'll start getting a little thicker than the other. You can start seeing a little bit of profile. We'll use that term, meaning that's slightly enlarged versus, like, you know, the opposite side. The good part about lameness work or evaluating the anatomy of a horse is you got two legs, so you can compare one to the other. So if you consider one to be normal, you know, on palpation, then you can, you know, consider the other to be abnormal if it's enlarged, you know. And then, of course, scanning, you can use measurements to compare, you know, so because, you know, you need bilateral symmetry, you know. So if one side's big and the other side's not, then that's pretty asymmetrical, I think, you know. Anybody can kind of figure that one out. As far as, I mentioned this one time before, when a horse comes out of a race, I usually personally hold my breath. And, you know, of course, I turn purple a lot, but I hold my breath for about a week. And I'll tell you why. I've seen horses run and win grade ones, and everything looked great the day after, and everything was great the day after that, and the day after that, and like 5, 6, 7 days after that, and all of a sudden that tendon's big and fat and ugly, and then we scan it, and it's got a big bow in it. Well, didn't show that right after the race because that medication, everything was on board and whatever. But when everything was finally worn off and, you know, and then the horse started back his first day, boom, it shows up. So, you know, I mean, it's a great thing when a horse is back in the tub and everything's good, looks good and cold and tight, but I still, 5 to 7 days is me. If they get past that point, man, then we got out of the race relatively unscathed. But until then, I probably hold my breath. I hate to admit it.
You said something about the two legs. Do these structures, and I'm just looking at this cutout that I put up, do they differ in the front versus the back?
Not really. I mean,
okay.
I mean, it's a little different from the, you know, where it goes over the hock, you know, versus the behind the carpus. There's a slight difference, you know, but and then the way they run over the limb itself, it's a little different too. I mean, but for all intents and purposes, from the hock down and from the carpus to the knee down, they're pretty much, you know, very similar type structure.
Okay, I was curious. All right, well, I hope.
You can tear tendons behind too, but it's not nearly as prevalent. I mean, it's like, you know, I mean, it doesn't happen very often. Let's put it that way.
And here's a crazy question. You know, we watch the entire internet has been fascinated by Clyde, the weanling that can't figure out how to roll in the sand. How often does a horse strain themselves or hurt themselves getting up and down?
Let's see. How about like slim and none?
Okay, I'm curious.
Yeah.
Because it is a convoluted process.
Oh yeah. But like I told you, I think you're going to find, like, you know, the old, you know, took a bad step story. You know, is that it's so, you know, rare, it's unusual. These injuries are called due to cyclic concussion, typically.
Period.
Overstretch, overtime.
Gotcha.
Yeah, and fatigue. Yeah.
All right, then wanted to ask. Let's turn our attention. I wanted people, you know, that are hearing about the soft tissue. We hadn't done one of these primers in ages, so I thought
sure.
It would be valuable with Honor AP's retirement.
Absolutely. Yep.
Turn our attention to the sale, Steve, and it's a dark day and crazy activity yesterday, the seven-figure sellers. Let's familiarize everybody with the vet role when evaluating yearlings and how you interface with the buyers and as a consultant, and whether it's scans or whether it's physical evaluation, the throats and everything else. Talk a little bit about how you work with people and input you know, your expertise on the sales front.
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, I breed horses for people, so I get some input there, but I don't, you know, I mean, you know, like I said, I have certain pedigrees I like. I know ones that I think stays sound or things like this. And if they ask me, I'll tell them. It comes down to quite simply this, is that, you know, they typically have bloodstock people that find these things. First thing I do is I always scope them first. It doesn't matter. They can be, like, they can look like Hercules. They can be Secretariat statue standing in the stall. He got a bad airway. I don't pass them. I don't look at the aerograms. I don't do a physical. I don't even walk them. You know, if they don't have an airway, I don't waste anybody's time and money, because, you know, that's the engine. If they can't breathe, they can't produce work, and they can't run, and the story, it's over. If they pass that part, I'll do a physical, watch them walk, make notes on feet, every aspect I can of their structure, if they're, you know, good angle, too long pass turn, back knee, turned in, turned out, you know, toed in, whatever, offset knees, you name it. And then, you know, because I'm pretty much, you know, after doing this for 35 years and working on a lot of nice horses, which I've been very blessed to do, by the way, you know, and I don't ever, you know, like I said, I never think that it's me, because I know better. But I just basically look and I tell them what the predilections are for the confirmation defects they have, or maybe the pedigrees of horses I've worked on, because I worked on a lot of nice horses, so I can tell you where the holes are, you know, or kind of like where the minefields are, so to speak. And bottom line is that, you know, if they fit the bill, what they're looking for, and they've got a good airway, I pass their confirmation and radiographs, and structurally they look good as far as soft tissue and whatnot, then, you know, listen, you dip into the pool and you bid on the one and hopefully get the one you want, because you're going to go up against competition, because I'm not the only vet out there, and they're usually not the only buyer, typically.
And on that topic, because I did, when I billed your visit, I mentioned how when it comes to things like radiographs and looking and noticing a fleck, let's say, in the knee or in an ankle,
yeah.
And some vets will look at it, and I hear this from, you know, from horsemen that I'm that I'm looking at horses with Gary,
right.
And you know, one vet will say that's not going to bother him there. I wouldn't worry about it, and the other one says that's got to come out.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I base that on moral experience. You know, I mean, Listen, the one thing they don't give, it'd be nice if they did, but one thing they don't give you when you get your vet degree is a crystal ball, you know? And I'm not much of a Ouija board, crystal ball, you know, kind of guy, you know? I mean, I base it on experience, and I try to keep that knowledge from the experience of what I can and can't live with. And, you know, after seeing a lot of horses for a long time and having to fix them in the war zone, which is racing, you know what you can and can't live with. You know, and I've learned, you know, hey, certain conformation, you're going to have a problem in certain areas. Other conformations, it's not that big a deal. You know, depends. I mean, I remember telling a guy that bought a really, really nicely bred horse that she was big and immature. If you wait on her, she's going to be fine. But you better find yourself a trainer. It's going to be really, really, like, you know, patient with her and bring her along slowly, and she'll be fine. Hell, she didn't turn out to be a grade one winner, multiple grade one winner. And because they gave her to the right guy in the right program. If she'd been in somebody else's program, she might not have, you know, reached that promised land. And she wouldn't have been a millionaire and sold for millions as well, you know. So it really, a lot of it's got to do with just, you know, making the right decision for the right connections. And, you know, when somebody's, you know, looking for a certain type, and I get enough input with the outfits or people I work with, is that I tell them, hey, man, this one will be okay with time, but, you know, you got to give it that. And, you know, so choose your connections wisely on this one. For others that are precocious, that I know the pedigrees, I've been around it, I know that's going to, I mean, a lot of times I know the mare and the sire.
Sure.
You know, and I say, hey, you're going to be okay with this one because both the mother and the sire ran early, so I think you're going to be okay here, you know?
Absolutely. And you mentioned the airway, and I referenced that too. Explain how you evaluate. I mean, there's the fist under the neck, but yeah. Explain.
You can take all that and throw it away. Whatever
you want the scope.
I basically predicted. I predicted a horse. A couple of horses were never going to race when I was looking at them as yearlings after they got broke, or they just were early 2 year olds, and neither one of them raced, and there was a lawsuit over it, and I had to testify in a court case, which doesn't make me real thrilled, okay? So, but two other guys that evaluated those horses said, hey, both these horses will race, and they tried to hang their hat on that, and they were both wrong, and I was right. So, you know, does that make me the genius? I don't think so, personally, but I just based it on my experience. I work on the racetrack, and I tell you what I can and can't live with. They don't work on the racetrack, and I don't think they could do that fairly. I don't do broodmares and things like that, so they could probably school me up on that. So that's how that works.
Well, and you know, there has been this discussion about limiting the amount of scoping of horses, young horses
great
in particular.
Idea. It's a great idea. The video scope system is the smartest thing that's ever come down the pike. Because if I own a really good horse and 20 guys want to scope it, I go, one scope, everybody gets to look at it, don't like it, don't buy it. End of story. I'm not going to do this. You're not going to ruin my horse. So.
Interesting. The complaint has been, Steve, and I had this discussion with Tommy Ventura, and
sure.
You know, OBS, you know, trying to get people to utilize the video scoping, and the complaint has been that everybody's vet wants to see it for themselves. Is that a you know, specious.
A valid statement? No, it's not.
It's not, okay.
No, I don't think so. It's bullshit. That's my opinion.
All right, because basically they're going to see the same thing no matter whose scope goes down the throat.
You got it.
There you go.
You know, everybody seems to think they've got the crystal ball. See, that's the crystal ball technique. I don't have that one of those. I told you that earlier, so.
Now, as always, the invaluable half hour with Dr. Stephen Allday, Horse Health Today, brought to you by Lubricin. And Steve, a quick update. And of course, when we spoke last in late June, you know, things were pretty much on hold. Any roping going on other than some backyard roping?
Funny you should ask. You know, my favorite subject. I went to Fort Worth last week. I hooked up with a 26-year-old man that basically I've known since he was in high school, 26, 27, 25, whatever it was. And he and I roped together in the 9.5 handicap roping. We were 13th tie call, fastest time. We put a clean run in. We ended up fifth out of 497 teams, and we got a big fat check, and we got to rekindle our friendship, and we had a great day.
That's great. I'm glad I asked. It's tremendous. I'm glad I asked. I love it. I love it. What about Lopresti? Get Lopresti out there on a get
nah,
him back
he
out.
He doesn't rope anymore. He quit.
He quit.
He's a bird hunter now.
I'm going to give him grief. I love it, Steve. And the business, everything good. Luberson Reborn.
Very good. Thank you. Yeah, we're doing good. Thank you.
All right, and Kim and everybody and family, all good.
I don't deserve them, but they're doing great. Yeah.
All right, Steve, this was great. I appreciate the catch-up and back at it, looking at yearlings, Dr. Steven Alday, everybody. You follow Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
Not at all. Thank you. Four Legs Doc on Twitter. And don't forget the alldayway.com, where Steve and Dr. Alday and Alex Hassinger will help you with your sport horse, your recreation horse, whatever it is, thealldayway.com. Lots of valuable information. And of course, Luberson, Luberison.com, and Reborn, the amazing colostrum product that, my God, solves, countless ills, in your horse. Amazing what Steve crafted with Reborn. Always great to catch up with Dr. Alday. Ripped from today's headlines, the news. We've got Ed DeRosa coming up at the bottom of the hour. We'll get Ed. Haven't done any postscript to Derby with Ed, but we're going to look at Kentucky Downs and Indiana, the pick five. So we'll do some of that, and we'll give Ed a chance to do the postscript to Derby Oaks weekend. And they're getting ready to reboot at Churchill. Let's do this, though. We're going to do another musical interlude. And the one issue I've got with these extended, more and more, we're pretty much doing straight hours with little 2 minute, 2.5 minute breaks at the top of each hour. But it's costing me coffee visits down to the kitchen for coffee. Take a quick break, and you're gonna like this. I don't know where I heard this the first time. It actually may have been on a soundtrack, the books and cello song that is really haunting. If you haven't heard this, you're going to like it. Back after this, and looking forward to a visit with Ed in a little bit.
The world to find.
Hmm. I,